At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Take something you use every day, something kind of critical. Now use 15% less of it. And let me know how that goes, would you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 20th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Marketplace number of the day today is 15. That is delivered to you as a percentage, of course, and it's the amount of natural gas use that the European Commission wants its member states to not use. That was the proposal from the Commission today, applicable to virtually all slices of the European economy. And it's going to be a difficult fall and winter over in the EU, thermally and geopolitically speaking. What to do about and how to do without Russian nat gas has been giving European leaders all kinds of headaches since Putin's invasion of Ukraine nearly 5 months ago. And it is very much an issue, as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports to get us going, of demand and supply.
More than a third of the gas Europe imports from Russia arrives by way of a pipeline called Nord Stream 1. It's been offline for the last few days for annual maintenance. The question now is how much gas Russia will send once it reopens tomorrow. Dan Fried is with the Atlantic Council.
Europe is facing the reality of Russia using energy as a weapon against all of Europe.
And while it's been hot in Europe, it's winter that worries many analysts.
The only way that we can move forward if we reduce demand.
Anna Maria Heyer-Makarevich is with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
That's the way we can fight this energy war. And every possible strategy to achieve that should be done.
The EU plan asks members to cut gas use by 15% through March. That would require industry and power companies to slash gas consumption. But Samantha Dart of Goldman Sachs says, unusually, the EU is also asking homeowners to use less.
Residential heating demand normally is considered a protected sector and one that is not normally targeted.
The worst-case scenario for the Europeans is that Russia doesn't just curtail how much gas it sends, but stops providing it altogether. The goal would be to prompt Europe to abandon its support for Ukraine. But for now, at least, the Atlantic Council's Dan Fried says Europe isn't bowing to Russia's demands.
They're not going there. And it's going to be a tough fight this winter.
How tough could depend on how much natural gas Europe is able to store now before it needs it most. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Natural gas in New York today, by the way, up 8.5%. Oil down just a bit. Equities green in varying degrees. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pause here, shall we, to pour one out for some of those corporate pandemic darlings, for the Pelotons that thought people would be riding bikes inside forever, only to have to announce last week that it's going to have to stop making its own bikes so it can get the exercise content right. And speaking of content, also the Netflixes that thought we'd all be sitting around on our couches streaming forever, only to announce yesterday that it lost nearly a million subscribers last quarter. Yes, that was half as many as they thought they'd lose, but you take my point, right? Look, though, On the one hand, you can't blame companies that rode the momentum they had during the lockdowns, right? On the other, though, ain't nothing last forever. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is here with a pandemic corporate strategy explainer.
When a company is faced with a huge period of disruption, say a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, it has a choice to make.
Whether you will be paralyzed or you will just, you know, enjoy the moment where the deck is in the air and everything gets reshuffled.
Anat Lechner is a professor of management at NYU. She says enjoying the moment, leaning into it, takes a lot of understanding about who you are as a company and how you've overcome challenges. Young businesses don't have that historical knowledge.
Some companies just go with the flow. And, you know, when the market demands growth out of you and you're able to kind of chase that, you end up becoming a whole lot less self-reflective.
Businesses would be crazy not to meet market demands by investing in growth, carpe diem and all that. But it means so many resources become tied up in the moment. Seizing the day sometimes means overlooking the future. And if the future brings slowing demand, it can hit some companies harder than others, says Randy Allen, a professor of strategy at Cornell.
I may have a lot of excess manufacturing capacity, warehousing capacity that I can't use.
Peloton bikes, grocery delivery, and binge watching were solutions to pandemic problems. Greg Portell, a consultant at Kearney, says now some companies need to figure out how to grow beyond being solutions.
Can you take a consumer and actually shape their behavior as opposed to react to their behavior?
Easier said than done when COVID has upended everything over and over again.
Anyone that's starting to think about a business cycle that lasts more than 90 days is a bit foolish.
In other words, companies may be justified in taking it one quarter at a time. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I spent a couple of days in Nashville last week. Stories from that trip to come. But while I was in town, I simply had to stop in at the Belcour Theater to see Stephanie Silverman. We first started talking to her in February of 2020 for our series, The United States of Work, the plan being for me to visit in person a couple of months later. The pandemic, of course, had other plans, both for travel and for the Belcour, which was forced to shut its doors at a time when it wasn't so clear that there would even be a future for movie theaters. Here's Stephanie talking about that in April of 2020.
You know, we're just very cognizant that the ramp up for us is going to be probably more towards the tail end of whatever kind of recovery looks like.
The Belcourt is a nonprofit theater. They show new indie movies, classics as well, in a nearly 100-year-old building. The Belcourt officially reopened in April of 2021 at limited capacity. That was thanks to donations and grants, two PPP loans, and a shuttered venue operator's grant as well. And when I showed up in person last week, after more than 2 years of Zoom calls with Stephanie, the Belcourt had just had its first weekend back at full capacity since before the pandemic.
Hey!
Hello!
How are you?
As I live and breathe. Welcome to the Belcourt, Tyrus.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
It's great to have you guys here.
Oh, my Lord. Let's go inside.
Come into the air conditioning and
wind. Oh, my. It's just, it's so hot here.
Yeah, welcome to the South.
I can't handle it. This is the place.
This is it. This is us.
This is the place.
We got there a little bit after lunchtime as they were setting up for the first screening of the day.
So this is one of our two halls.
Yeah.
We call it the 1966 because it was built onto the building.
Oh.
In 1966.
Good sized. How many people?
So this seats 255. Okay. And the cool thing about this room is we can show digital films in here, like every other theater in America. But this is also the room where we can show 35 millimeter. So we love that.
I will say the darkness and the coolness makes me just want to sit down and see a movie.
Can you imagine with a little popcorn?
Right?
And if you're here, you can also have a solid beer. Yeah.
That would put me to sleep. Although I will say I'm not wild about the idea of Marcel the Shell with shoes on. It does nothing for me.
Have you even seen the trailer?
I saw the trailer the other day.
It's kind of magical.
All right. Okay.
Well, it's okay if you don't come. But what we were happy to see is a whole lot of Nashvillians came. So we had a really, really good opening weekend.
Good. All right. So that's the 1966 hall. In the other hall, Willy Wonka was on the playbill. The 1970s one, not the weird Johnny Depp one. Anyway, then we headed upstairs.
Oh, do you want to see the booth, though?
Yeah, I kind of do.
Okay, then you kinda have to come back this way.
Just like for the...
We'll look at the good booth. I mean, they're both good booths, but this one has both the digital and the 35 in it. Come on in.
Oh, yeah.
So here it is.
Look at how big they are, those reels of film.
Yes. That's an exceptionally
crazy.
Large reel.
Oh,
Kirk
right.
could tell us. So Kirk is our director of projection and facilities.
Hi, Kirk.
This is Kai Rizdahl,
Marketplace
team.
Nice to see you. How are you?
Good to meet you. Good.
But here are reels for films that are coming up this weekend. So we're showing Malcolm X as part of an American epic series.
One. Yep. All of those reels is one movie?
Yeah.
About 20 minutes each, somewhere around there. So they have to be swapped back and forth between the projectors, you know, every 15 or 20 minutes. So
that seems not very efficient, but maybe that's just me.
Well, they created all these ways to do it when film really was it.
Back
these platter
the day,
systems
right? yeah.
and these huge things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now you're playing archival prints most of the time. So we don't cut these guys. We treat them like a museum would treat the work on their walls.
So you have a staff member up here whose job it is to switch between projector A and projector B at the right synchronized moment. And
exactly. Yep. They watch for a little dot in the top right corner.
Okay,
and
right.
then when they see it, they switch it over. And the audience never notices.
And
I
it's
was just gonna say,
art.
Thanks, Kirk.
See
you.
All right. And
you know what's funny? We totally just like intruded on his little private space. He's up here with his machines and his films, and he's good to go. And then we were like,
hey, man,
how are you?
That's right? projectionist style. There was like an eighth grade career fair here in Nashville, and we'd go. And, of course, most kids would come up and say, how do I become a movie star?
Yeah.
But then every once in a while, you'd get a kid just kind of rolling by, and Kirk would go, that kid's projectionist material.
Oh, that's great. So let's see. A couple of things that I wanted to touch base with. Number one, crowds are good, right?
Yeah. We just had a great weekend. It looked like a normal Belcourt weekend.
Is that all Marcel?
It's mostly Marcel. Then we have this really great series right now going on called Queer Classics. We try and work in the repertory space, finding maybe the voices and the artists who have gotten less play than the old white guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
totally fair.
Yeah.
People, staff.
Yeah.
So they're going to start rolling in. I saw that on the front it said you guys open at 2, so we're early, but they're going to roll in here.
Yep.
Are you staffed up? Do you need people?
We need maybe a couple more people, but we're pretty good right now. The big thing we've had to do is really significantly raise our hourly rates.
Like how significantly?
Overall, since we've reopened, $4 an hour. That's a lot.
The increase?
Yeah.
On what kind of base?
So we started at 10, and now we're at 14 an hour starting. So we're not even to 15, which is our at least where we'd like to get, but we're getting there faster than we thought, which is a thing that I think the pandemic is forcing everyone to do, which is an upside.
So let me ask the follow-on question, which is inflation and the cost of goods sold for you and all of that. I mean, I don't imagine Malcolm X's prints cost more, but all the wine and all the beer and all the popcorn.
All this stuff costs more. The Malcolm X piece that costs more is shipping, right? It's just plain old delivery.
Sure.
Because those movies are heavy. I mean, they've always been expensive, but we really have seen an increase.
Yeah.
There's been a funny sort of shortage nationally of popcorn buckets, for instance. We're on a listserv of other art houses, and people are like, where's everybody getting their buckets?
Oh,
we're out here. So
where are you getting your buckets?
We're okay right now. We use these lovely compostable bags.
Oh, there you go.
But we did run out of them earlier, and we had to go back to buckets. So it's its own jigsaw puzzle. The movies are a jigsaw puzzle. The concessions work is its own jigsaw puzzle. That's been the coming out of pandemic work mostly, problem solving around things we used to think we knew how to do.
Hmm. Setting aside for a second the variants and the idea that we're done with the pandemic, but the pandemic's not done with us, do you think business-wise you're on the far side of the pandemic?
I think we're getting there. I think for us, the feeling that people are really understanding how much audiences love seeing movies in theaters is for real. And it's not just in our space, in the independent space, but certainly in the commercial space too. Like with the out-of-the-gate success of Spider-Man and Top Gun and Thor, those people aren't waiting. They don't want to wait. They want to see them in a theater. We're seeing that here too. Interestingly for us, the pipeline's been funky, right? Like, the place we are is the place where the Netflix streaming deals have happened the most. But we've been surviving on repertory, really, until about this weekend with Marcel, which is theaters only, and people are coming. So those are accessible to anybody at all times.
Do you worry about the rise of streaming and released direct-to-streaming features after the pandemic?
I worried about it more than I worry about it now. I think we're going to see a correction for two reasons. One, I think studios are understanding that the long tail for their movie happens when it starts an exhibition, when we do marketing and audience development for it, and then it finally lands streaming, and then, but it needs the word of mouth energy that only exhibition spaces can give it. The other thing is that the creative community doesn't love it either.
Right.
If everything's sort of the same, right? You can release anything anywhere, nothing is special. Nothing has delineation. So I think the other thing is that artists care about exhibition. They care about movies. They care that we care enough to sit in there with a many years old movie like Willy Wonka and tune it and make sure that theater sounds great and looks great so that you have the very best experience watching it.
It is so good to be here and see you.
It's so great to have you guys here after all this time.
It's so fun. Now I have a place to think about when we talk.
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, next time you come to Nashville,
we'll see a movie.
Come see a movie.
Coming up!
Click here just to allow us to authorize your payment.
No. Don't just randomly click. Don't do that. First, though, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 47 points today, a 10%, 31,874. The NASDAQ up 184 points, almost 1.6%, 11,897. The S&P 500 added 23 points, about 0.6%, 39.59. Netflix jumped 7.3%. Today, the streaming service, as I said, posted second quarter results late yesterday, showing it lost fewer subscribers than some had predicted. Also, the company itself, by the way. Kristen Schaub was telling us about how well businesses have been planning for these times when COVID is less prevalent, or perhaps not planning. Well, get a load of this. In a new poll from Axios Ipsos, 78% of respondents said they don't think COVID's going to go away in their lifetimes. 54% said other Americans were behaving in a way that's hurting the nation's recovery from the pandemic. Bond prices basically flat. Yield on the 10-year, 3.02%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Contrary to what you might hear, okay, yes, fine, on this program sometimes, but most times everywhere else, the Federal Reserve is not the only central bank in the world. You got Japan, you got the Bank of China, the Bank of England for sure. Also, the European Central Bank, which has arguably the toughest central bank job in the world, trying to set monetary policy across the 19 euro-using member states, each of which has its own particular macroeconomic needs. And so here is the present challenge for the ECB. During the pandemic, government debt kind of exploded in the eurozone, just like here, to be honest. And that was all well and good when the ECB was in quantitative easing mode, snapping up bonds of some of the heavily indebted countries over there, like Greece and Italy, Spain as well. Bond yields were low, pretty much the same also across the continent. But now with inflation having its way over there, quantitative easing is, as you know, a thing of the past. Bond yields are up and they are diverging across the continent. And so tomorrow, the ECB is due out with its plan to set things right. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Last week in Brussels, a rare moment of rejoicing as Christine Lagarde, head of the European Central Bank, welcomed Croatia, the latest member state, to adopt the euro.
Congratulations. This is a time for celebration. This is the 20th member of the euro area
Anne Lagarde trumpeted the benefits of Euro membership, especially in these troubled times.
The Euro area and the Euro in and of itself act as a shield, because united we are stronger.
30-40!
But even as she spoke, the euro was plunging on the currency markets, falling to a 20-year low against the US dollar. Not surprising, really. While the Fed is highly likely to push interest rates up aggressively to combat inflation, hardly anyone expects the ECB to be anything like as tough. Stefan Legger is an economist with the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland.
The ECB is now between a rock and a hard place. It must fight inflation, that's the mandate, but the debt levels are too high to be able to afford higher interest rates.
In Greece, for example, public debt has topped 190% of GDP. The figure for Italy, the Eurozone's third largest economy, is 150%.
The fear is back that Italy or Greece or some other countries will not be able to afford higher levels of interest and could go bankrupt.
Those fears have driven up the bond yields of the Eurozone's most heavily indebted governments, making them diverge from those of the stronger economies. Lorenzo Codogno of the London School of Economics says it's rather reminiscent of the debt crisis that almost blew up the euro a decade ago.
Maybe a slightly different type of crisis, but it might develop again. Given that the eurozone is still a fragile construction, the whole system is still pretty fragile.
Since the debt crisis, the ECB has calmed investor concerns by buying large amounts of those weaker, mostly southern eurozone government bonds, about $5 trillion worth. This kept bond yields low and prevented them from diverging. But the banks stopped these purchases this month because they were deemed to be fueling inflation. And that, says Sarah Fowler of Oxford Analytica, leaves the bank in a quandary.
Ultimately, it's hard to see how the ECB gets out of this cycle of the divergences just widening between northern and southern member states and the constant risk of a debt crisis not being that far away.
Tomorrow, the bank says it will raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years, and it will also unveil its plan for averting another debt crisis. None of the economists we consulted thought the euro's problems would be terminal, however. Stefan Legger said it's a trade-off. The problems are the price the EU is paying for a political symbol.
From an economic point of view, this whole euro area never made much sense. But it was not an economic project. It was a political project. It was a political symbol. We have a common currency.
The cost of that symbol, he says, could be higher inflation and a weaker currency than many of the northern member states, especially Germany, would prefer. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One could argue, should one so choose, that a technology really arrives when it becomes a verb. See also Xerox, for instance, right? Or from early in the dot-com days, Google, of course. And more recently in this mobile economy, Venmo, as in Venmo me for the rent or beer or whatever, peer-to-peer payment apps. It's not just Venmo, to be clear. There are Zelle and PayPal and the Cash App. And with their rise in popularity can also come a rise in fraud. And the Wall Street Journal reports today the CFPB, that's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is set to push banks to pay back customers who get scammed on those apps. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
If you use peer-to-peer payment systems, someone's probably tried to scam you.
Well, I've certainly get attempts for it all the time.
Lisa Ellis is a partner and senior research analyst at MoffittNathanson, whose parent company has peer-to-peer apps as clients.
A typical one would be you get an email or a text message from a fraudster that's impersonating your bank. So what it often says, you know, we're trying to complete your recent payment, and then it's some sort of threat, right?
Ellis says the companies haven't disclosed how much consumers have lost from the scams, but she estimates it's around $10 billion.
There's no regulatory requirement that requires the banks or the service providers to pay back consumers if they fall for a scam.
But if companies are pushed to reimburse consumers, then these services will cost more, says Scott Talbot with the Electronic Transactions Association, a trade group. Or, he says, those instant payments might become less instant.
we may inject or insert time between when you hit send and when the recipient receives it, designed to determine that is this transaction actually real or is it fraud?
Others say if a payment is a scam, then it should go slow. Lauren Saunders is with the National Consumer Law Center.
And everybody is going to be better off if payment companies and banks have an incentive to make it safe because people aren't going to use the systems if they're not.
Marketplace reached out to the CFPB about the report on the new guidance. The agency responded with a statement that said, quote, reports and consumer complaints of payment scams have risen sharply, and financial fraud can be devastating for victims. The CFPB is working to prevent further harm, end quote. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, wrapping up the housing week in this economy. We got data on existing home sales today from the National Association of Realtors. The number of those sales was down, but the price was up. Median sale price last month, a record $416,000. You bundle that with higher interest rates and you get slower sales. In June, down 5.4% from May, the fifth monthly drop in a row. All right, off we go, but here is your moment of economic context. This one from the corporate balance sheet files. Tesla announced quarterly earnings this afternoon. They did fine, sold 564,000 cars the first half of the year. That's a little bit behind their full-year expectations. Here's the tidbit, though, that I wanted to tell you. The company has sold off about 75% of its pile of Bitcoin, added about $1 billion cash. That's actual fiat money cash that you can actually use, you know? Anyway, it's coffers. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.